the Eternity Podcast Network, eternitypodcasts.com.au.
Hello, I'm Jenny Salt, and welcome to Salt, a place where we'll enter into the lives of people and discover heartwarming, sometimes challenging, yet always distinctive gospel stories.
It is a different culture or set of cultures, because one of the things I've learned is that anything I say about America is wrong about another part of America. And that's a nuance that's lost in Australian television. They don't see that it's a mosaic.
My guest today is Graham Cole. Graham, together with his wife Jules, have been involved in Christian ministry for more than 40 years. It's taken them to many places around the world, and for 20 of those years in the Midwest of the USA. They're back in Australia now, but still feel very connected to the country and the Christians they left behind. Welcome, Graham.
Well, thank you, Jenny. It's good to be with you.
Graham, firstly, where did you grow up?
Look, I grew up in Sydney, Jenny, in Bondi until I was about seven. And then Kirribilli was where I had my primary school and high school before I got married.
And when you hear words like Bondi, or when Aussies hear Bondi or Kirribilli, they sound quite idyllic. Is that what it was like for you growing up beside, you know, the harbour or the ocean?
Well, that's a good question. Being only seven when I left Bondi, I don't remember a great deal about the sights, but it really wasn't the kind of idyllic setting it is now. Mm. I think it's really just made a quantum leap as far as being a tourist attraction.
Well, exactly. I mean, it is quite iconic throughout the world. So you grew up, your memories of childhood were mainly in Kirribilli, which again is a beautiful part of the world and a beautiful part of Sydney. And you describe your childhood in terms of being a latchkey kid, which some people may not have heard that term before. What does it mean to be a latchkey kid, and what did that mean for you?
Well, Jenny, we left Bondi when the marriage broke up. And then I became the only child of a single parent, my mother. And we lived in a rent-controlled flat in Kirribilli. It was very small. Kirribilli wasn't the kind of place it is now then either.
Yeah.
And a latchkey kid is someone where, you know, your parent goes to work. And in my mother's case, for years, she then studied at night to become an accountant. And so from, you know, breakfast through to 10 o'clock at night during the week, I was on my own. I had a key. And that made you a latchkey kid. You were able to get in and out, but you were without a parent.
So you would make your breakfast, head off to school, come home, do your homework, make your dinner, go to bed, pretty much on your own. Is that right?
Yes, but in between I got up to mischief.
Okay. What kind of mischief did you get up to?
Oh, well, I experimented with firearms. I turned my air rifle into a 22 caliber firearm.
Well, that's very clever, Graham.
Well, yeah, very dangerous when I think about it.
Yes.
I did a lot of just walking. You know, I'd walk from Kirribilli to Taronga Park Zoo, for example. I was a great walker because I had nothing else to do. And I went fishing because of the wharves around Kirribilli. In many ways, fishing was really my main occupation apart from school and watching television.
I'm watching television. And your mum and dad were divorced. Did you have much or a lot or little contact with your dad?
It was episodic, Jenny, because he was a ship's captain. So I only saw him, even when the marriage was intact, only so many weeks out of a couple of months. And so in many ways, it wasn't as disruptive as it would have been for a lot of kids. And my parents were actually separated for decades and eventually got divorced when I was in my 40s, I think it was.
Okay, yeah. And what about religion and more specifically Christianity? How did that feature in your early years?
Well, my mother was Roman Catholic and my father was an old-time rationalist, which meant he was a Colonel Ingersoll man, which people probably would know that name, but it was like Richard Dawkins back then. And so the compromise between Roman Catholicism and atheism was the Church of England. Halfway between. So eventually they decided I needed to be baptized. I was about seven, actually, just before the marriage broke up, and I got baptized and was nominally Anglican for a long, long time. And just had very rare church experiences up until I was about 18.
So, I mean, you're a Christian and you are actually have been very much involved in the Anglican Church. How did you become a Christian?
Well, I had some friends at school in my last year of school who were praying for me. They kept inviting me to their little church. And, you know, my grandmother could only get sick so many Sundays in a row as an excuse. And eventually I said yes. And so I was taken along to this Brethren Chapel in Willoughby. And that night there was a special group singing. That's why they invited me, I guess, a gospel outreach group called the Living Stones. And they sang around an organ, and then the preacher was a plumber by trade, and he spoke very simply and very powerfully about the love of God in the cross. Jesus died for you. Respond to him. Put your life in his hands. And I got really convicted about that when I went home that night, and I just cried out to God, don't forsake me, don't forsake me. I felt that I was over a great abyss. All I can say, Jenny, is the next day I was a different person, so much so that I went back to, you know, school the next day. I was in year 12 and said to my Christian friends, what's happened to me? I can't lie anymore. What's wrong? Because I used to be a great bull artist. And they started asking me about all these stories. I had lots of stories. And I said, no, that was a lot of bull. That was a lot of bull. Then they told me I was born again.
Wow.
And truly,
how old were
I
you
was.
Then? Yeah, now, that's
the,
right.
The wonderful thing is I came to Christ, obviously, but also got a wife because I ended up marrying one of the singers who was a daughter of the preacher.
That is amazing. And that is Jules, your
That's
wife
Jules.
Of how many years, Graham? How many years for you and Jules?
Married 50 years this year.
50 years this year. Wow. Well, that's wonderful. So, and you met, so Jules was one of the singers of the Living Stones. And the man who preached that night was Jules' dad.
Yeah. James Livingston. McKendrick Clark. So that's how Livingston had, you know, double meaning.
And from the day that you were born again, the day that you became a Christian, you could no longer lie. Your story's now perhaps not as embellished. How else did you change, Graham?
Oh, I wanted to preach. You know, I'd come to Christ because someone preached the gospel very simply to me, and I wanted to share that with other people. And within about a year, I was the preacher of that group. And we traveled around Sydney, parts of New South Wales on the weekend. And I started off by giving my testimony and then ultimately preaching terrible sermons, but they were very enthusiastic.
Lots of passion, maybe, you know. I always think it would be really good to hear people who are involved in preaching and teaching ministries to hear their first or second or third sermon. I think we'd be quite encouraged that, you know, you don't become a great preacher from day one.
That is true. But, you know, the wonderful rabbi saying comes to mind, God can hit a hard blow with a crooked stick.
Well,
and so,
you,
you know,
yeah.
God even used my very, you know, not thought out preaching to begin with.
So, but you did have a passion for preaching.
Yeah.
So that actually took you to studying at Bible College, at Moore Theological College. Is that right, Graham?
Yes. Yeah, I was going to Sydney University. I was now a Christian. Mm. And I was confronted with secular philosophy, secular psychology. And I asked my brethren elders about this, and they had, you know, they really didn't know what to say to me. But I was getting help from the Moore College lecturers who came along to the campus ministry at Sydney University. And from the books on the bookstore, you know, the John Stotts and the Jim Packers and the Michael Greens. Yes. And so that made me think I really do need to know much more. And these people from Moore were very impressive people in their just their eloquence, their depth. So I thought, maybe I really belong in that kind of world more than the brethren world.
Yes.
Just because of the need to go much deeper theologically.
Yeah. Yes, yes. So you did go to Bible College, you did study, and then you took up various roles in the local church. Do you have any memories of those early years post-college? As I think back then you were called a curate, is that right, Graham?
That's right, you know, like the assistant minister, associate minister.
Yeah.
And I was at St. Paul's Chatsworth and St. James Tarramurra, and they were very formative experiences.
Mm.
I learned a lot in both places and from both ministers. And I also learned a lot in the 4 years at Moore because I was a catechist, a minister in training for 4 years, 2 years at St. David's at Forestville, Killarney Heights, and then at Christ Church St. Ives.
Hmm. So you really stuck to the north side of things, didn't you, Graham? You're a bit of a north side, North Sydney type of guy.
Well, that seems to have been, you know, where Providence placed me.
Yes,
and
right.
I married a lovely lady from Lane Cove.
Yes, there we are. So did you anticipate being, you know, part of the local church, whether it was on the north side or not, long term? Because that's not how it worked out.
No, it didn't, Jenny. I thought I'd be in a local church ministry. But then, you know, 1 week while I was at St. James Tarramurra, I got a phone call from Broughton Knox of Moore College.
Yes.
Inviting me back onto the faculty as a member of the faculty rather than a student. And so, you know, we prayed about it and it really did seem this was the Lord's leading. But I thought I'd be just at Moore College for maybe 10 years or so and then back into a local church. But you know, it just didn't work out that way.
No.
I found God used whatever talents I've got in that setting in a way that was very encouraging.
Yeah. And when you say God used one of the talents you got, what is that talent or that gift, Graham? What are you referring to?
The gift of the gab. I think that people tell me I can put complex ideas in a simple way that's not simplistic.
Yes.
And I'm listenable and I can think clearly and write clearly. And they seem to be very useful things in teaching people.
They are useful things for teaching. And in fact, I've been the recipient of that in another context and I can attest to the fact that you can make very complex, profound truths very understandable, but without being simplistic. So I can certainly attest to that. So you were teaching at Moore and then where did you go from there? Because you didn't stay there.
No, I thought I'd be at Moore for a long time, but really college came knocking and they wanted a principal and I went through the process thinking this is a lot of fun. Look at these terrific people. I wonder who will be the principal. It turned out to be me. And so we moved to Melbourne in 92 and for 10 years I was the principal of Ridley College.
And is that something that, you know, working as principal as opposed to being on faculty, did that appeal to you?
Well, I found it very tough because I was very green. I was only about, 42 or something, a big responsibility. It was a university college, one of the 12 of the University of Melbourne back then, and a theological college, so two student bodies, in effect two teaching bodies, shared administration. So it was a big ask. But I was still teaching, of course, and writing a little bit of articles and things like that. So that side was still going on. Learned a huge amount, made some mistakes, of course. But I think God was pleased to use those years in good ways too for that, for Bibby College and its ministry.
So there's Jules alongside you always. And tell us about your family.
Well, Jenny, we have our eldest is Jonathan. He's married to Eva, her little boy Luca. They're in Canberra. Eva works in the government. Jono is the assistant director of a centre of public Christianity at Charles Sturt University. Forget the long title myself. middle son is Jerome. He's a wedding photographer, gifted artist, married to Judith, who's also an artist, teaches art, and they have James and Aisha. They're in Melbourne. And then we have Hannah, who's married to Victor, and she has her son Isaiah, and then it's a blended family. So then we have Reuben, Haley, and Sarah as well, and we're a bit of a kind of United Nations, because Eva's Greek, Judith is from Northern Ireland, and Victor is from Mexico.
Goodness, it is a United Nations.
My grandson Isaiah is Ethiopian Australian.
Wow, that's amazing. And when you're at Ridley, the family were growing up, and at the end of the 10 years, you and Jules made another move, which was a big one. It wasn't just within Australia. Tell us about that move.
Well, Jenny, we've always, as a couple, been available to where the Lord would have us go. So we're always movable. And it was getting towards the end of 10 years at Ridley, and we were praying about, you know, what the Lord would have us do. And I'd had the opportunity to go and teach at Oak Hill College in London for 6 months in 98, which I was back in the classroom full time, loved it. And I thought, oh, wow. And then I was invited to go to TEDS, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Chicago, in 99 in January to teach a intensive. And the great, leader of TEDS was Kenneth Kanzer. And he took me aside during those 2 weeks and said, look, if you don't make a move back into the classroom at your age now, you'll never get back into the classroom. So that got me thinking. So we were praying. And in the course of, you know, getting towards the end of 10 years, I got an invitation to apply for the presidency of a North American seminary. I got an invitation to be a principal in a British theological college. And I got an invitation to apply to be a professor at TEDS in Chicago. And it just seemed good to us to explore the TEDS option. And indeed, 2002, we found ourselves in Chicago.
While we have a quick break, let me introduce you to our Associates Program. This Wednesday morning lecture program is for people over 50 who may now have more time on their hands and want to dig deeper into the Bible without the pressure of exams or assignments. You can come to one, a few, or ideally come to all 12 lectures in the series. There will be a different subject for each semester, and you'll also join in with the main weekly chapel service called Principal's Hour. It's such a popular program. So if that age group is you, or you know someone who is over 50, why not check out the Associates Program? For all the details, visit the Studies section of snbc.edu.au and look for the Associates Program. We're exposed in Australia to the American culture. We think we understand it, but I don't think we do. And there you were now in the Midwest, settling into life there. Do you remember the first memories, or first experiences, or that first year of moving from Melbourne to Chicago?
Oh, yes. It was an extraordinary time to be in America because 9/11 had really only happened within 6 months of our arrival.
Yeah.
And the country was so unified. American flags were everywhere. They were, you know, on mastheads. They're on cars. They're in lawns. People were wearing American flags. It was incredible. So that was the atmosphere. And, you know, the longer we were there, the more we realized that, you know, actually, we're not Americans. We're Australians. And it is a different culture or set of cultures. Because one of the things I've learned is that anything I say about America is wrong about another part of America. And that's a nuance that's lost in, if you watch English television, which we've done, or Australian television, that they don't see that it's a mosaic. And so that was one of the things that we learned, how diverse the place is, because it's an amazing country. It's founded on ideas. And two of the big words that we kept hearing over and over and over again, more than we had ever heard in Australia in an entire lifetime up until that point, were dream. You've got to have a dream. And the other thing we learned was freedom and all its cognates, freedom, liberty. Those words were just everywhere in the culture, and still are, of course. And that was very foreign.
Yes. And so you felt foreign, you know, in that culture, particularly perhaps in the earlier times, perhaps the whole time. Do you think that people saw you and Jules as foreign? How did the Americans relate to you, particularly when they first met you?
I just love your accent. It's so good.
Sounds like a southern accent there, Graham.
Well, yeah, of course, you spent 4 years in Birmingham, so
yes,
as well as all the years in Chicago.
Yeah,
they love Australians. They all want to come to Australia, but they won't come because they'll be bitten and eaten by something.
That is, well, they've got a point.
But they love it, and they love your accent. We're exotic. And that was very helpful in ministry because it meant you got a hearing. You could say probably exactly the same thing as someone else, but because you had an accent and you're exotic, you may have got a better hearing.
And what about in the classroom, Graham? Because I think we have certain ways of expressing ourselves that might be exotic, but perhaps not necessarily understood. Did you have any times in the classroom where what you said and what you meant was very different to what the students heard and understood?
Oh, well, the classic example was my very first seminar. I was teaching it with the church historian, and Scott Manage, fabulous person and historian. And he introduced me as a very casual Australian. So I thought, oh, I better illustrate this. Oh, yes, we are casual in Australia. I said, you know, I remember going to a communion service and the minister wore thongs. Well, you know, the class went catatonic. They just didn't know where to look. I didn't know what was happening. But Sam Chan, who probably many people know, was in my class. I ended up being,
he's an Aussie.
Yeah, he is.
And very Aussie, actually.
Oh, absolutely. So, Graham, mate, it doesn't mean that here. Flip-flops. They're flip-flops.
Flip-flops. That's better.
Everyone relaxed. But unfortunately, I would never be known at TEDS as the dean or a professor or a writer or a speaker. I'm the thong man.
Oh, the thong man. Wow, Graham, that is something. That is quite a legacy that you've left there. In a sense, you have to kind of modify your speech, but did you always modify it, you know, Americanize it, or did you stick with some of the Aussie-isms that they grew to understand and love?
Oh, I couldn't help myself. You know, I remember one I used, actually not in the classroom, but at a leadership meeting. I talked about something just being a dog's breakfast. Well, I tell you what, I became a stand-up comic from that point on. They were just enraptured by all these Aussies and still are, you know.
Yes.
They just slip out. And I remember just with my leadership team, they asked me about my Aussieisms from time to time. I said, well, look, the Savo, I'm going to have a Sambo with Avo. but I better not overeat, otherwise the ambos will come for me.
So we know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, they just love it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that would have made life in America a lot of fun. What about the hard things? Were there hard things about, you know, settling into a new routine there, teaching and just generally adjusting to a new place?
Yes, it was particularly difficult for Jules. You know, she left haute couture. She's a fashion designer. And there was nothing for the first 6 months for her to do until the Lord provided her a teaching job, teaching fashion at college level. And that's just opened up a chapter in her life where she writes fashion textbooks and does fashion. And, you know, God was very good. But that was a tough 6 months, the first 6 months for her especially. For me, what were the demands on me? Well, I think that, you know, lots of students, lots of grading. As one of my colleagues said, he would teach at TEDS for nothing, but grading's going to cost you. And so there was lots of that. But generally, I really enjoyed the life God gave us there. I missed home. You know, I missed the smell of eucalyptus. And I missed parrots, the songs of parrots.
Interesting.
And, of course, one of the great contributions to world culture by Australia is the vanilla slice. So I missed the vanilla slice.
And coffee, Graham.
Oh, the coffee, yes. Yeah. Starbucks. We must pray for Starbucks. It's got so much to answer for. I actually think the Russians are behind Starbucks.
Well, there's a scoop.
Because it's so overbrewed. We did find some good coffee, but, you know, having spent all those years in Melbourne and coming back every year, which is a great blessing, I called it my accent refreshment program. Came back every year for about 4 weeks. You know, the coffee here is just marvelous. It's getting much better in the States. And again, it's where you are. I'm sure you get great coffee in New York, San Francisco, and so on, and Chicago downtown. But in the suburbs, maybe not so much.
Graham, in the early years of your time in America, you would have been involved in obviously teaching Christians who were being equipped for ministry, but also part of the local church. What were your first or early impressions of Christians in America? Or another way of putting it, you know, what was your impression of Jesus in America?
Well, that's a really interesting question that would take a session in itself, I think.
Yes.
The perception of Jesus really depended upon the depth of someone's biblical knowledge. At a place like TEDS, which is really a place that's very similar to Moore College and Ridley College. When you have people like Don Carson on the faculty, no surprise. So amongst faculties, I've found a very solid, evangelical, biblically informed grasp of who Jesus is. But go out into the wider evangelical scene, and this would be true particularly in the South, but also in the North as I experienced it, there is a folk evangelicalism that you don't have in Australia. By that I mean people made a decision for Jesus when they were 12 or 13 at a camp or at a church. It made absolutely no difference to their life. But when a census comes along and if they're asked if they're an evangelical, they'll tick the box. So that folk evangelicalism was still very strong in 2002, 2003. But by the time I left in 2021, it had dissipated and is dissipating very, very quickly. Just before I left for Australia, I had lunch with Eddie Gibbs, a former Brit, became an American, taught at Fuller Seminary for many years. He was the professor of church health. And he told me in this lunch down in Melbourne that every year he would come back to Australia because he thought that's where America would be in 10, 15 years' time. I think he was right. So what I'm seeing with the ebbing and away of folk evangelicalism in the States is what I saw with nominal Christianity in the 60s.
I want to tell you about another podcast, which is a great listen. It's called Evangelism in a Skeptical World with Sam Chan. Now, if you know anything about Sam, he is a great evangelist. He's very well thought through and has some great advice on what it means to talk about the gospel in a modern context. To find out more about this and other great podcasts, go to eternitypodcasts.com. It would be lovely to be the front seat watching the politics, because I don't know, some people don't find American politics particularly interesting, although I do think Trump made it very interesting. What's your take on politics and Americans and especially Christians?
That's a big question. Actually, I'm a political junkie. I love that sort of stuff. America was set up with a constitution and three branches of government: the Congress, the executive, that is the president, and the judiciary, the Supreme Court. It was set up, I found out, to be deliberately inefficient. And that is, they can each block at the other. So it was set up to prevent tyranny, prevent another George III. And of course, as it's become a very, very complicated world, that creates real problems, plus some of the amendments that have been made, especially about guns, etc. So watching this in action or inaction, that's been fascinating too. And then to have such interesting presidents from, you know, Bush to Obama to Trump, and to Biden, goodness me, talk about swings. Mm. And as for evangelicals, you've got to ask yourself, what evangelicals are we talking about? Are we talking about white evangelicals, largely Republican? Are we talking about Hispanic evangelicals, mainly Democrat, but increasingly Republican? Are we talking about black evangelicals, almost exclusively Democrat? And then the stats. You've got to be careful with the stats. Like, you hear the statistic, 80% of white evangelicals voted for Trump first time around, but only 56% of them turned up at the polls. 44% didn't. And it was very interesting in that I had faculty talk about their votes in a way they had never done with Obama and with Bush, but they couldn't help themselves. And they'd say things like, look, I'm a lifelong Republican, but I voted for Hillary.
Wow.
Amazing, yeah.
That is shocking.
I'm a lifelong Republican, but I couldn't vote. Mm. You know, or I'm a lifelong Republican. I held my nose. I voted for Trump because he may make a difference at the Supreme Court.
Which he did, actually, in that sense.
Conservatives on the Supreme Court, which will have big implications for years and years. It's a lifetime appointment. Mm. So there are people who held their nose and voted for Trump. So it's quite complex as to why people voted, say, as evangelicals for Trump, or didn't vote for Trump. But I think Russell Moore, the Southern Baptist spokesman for a long time, now of Christianity Today, he put it really well. American Christians have to learn to transition from being a moral majority to a prophetic minority. And I think that we've been a minority in Australia for a long, long, long
that's
time.
That's true. That's but right.
The prophetic part may be the key part going forward.
Yes, yes. And what about, Graham, with COVID playing out? That was interesting to watch because we were kind of, you know, about 6 months behind. So how did you observe that? Because you lived in the COVID times in the States as well.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I was on the COVID task force for, TEDS for Trinity National University. So I lived and breathed COVID 7 days a week, as it were. And probably the wrong metaphor, isn't it, about breathing COVID?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Excuse me while I cough. and you know, that was very challenging. And, you know, people were getting COVID, dying, faculty, students getting COVID. Fortunately, well, blessedly, really, we didn't get it and we got vaccinated. So to begin with, it was disastrous. There was, mishandling all over the place. But, you know, it's typical America, huge amount of resilience and energy and can-do, mentality. So out come the vaccines and they come rolling out big time. And so they're finishing much better, even though there's been a surge of COVID because Delta 19 kind of outflanks things. But one thing they did do, which was really interesting, my wife was vaccinated in a different setting to myself. And what happened was the National Guard, like the Army Reserve, they were trained to give the jab. So she went into the United Center where the Bulls play, the basketball game, and there were just hundreds of military people giving the jab. So that was something they were able to, utilize, which was something that has not happened in Australia to anywhere near that degree. Mm. I thought it was a good move.
You're back in Melbourne now. Graham, when you and Jules came back, what did you experience in terms of a reverse culture shock?
Oh, I think that's going to play out over a number of years. I have noticed a change in students because I'm teaching. I find students are giving much more positive feedback than they would have years ago. Now, maybe because I'm better at what I do, that's always possible. but they seem to be open to doing that more than I remember, 20 years back. One of the big shocks here is there isn't the gun culture. Look, it pervades America. In Chicago, our worst weekend before we left were about 104 shootings, about 20 killed. The papers are so, bland in comparison, happily. So that's a difference. The amount of choice you've got everywhere in America, compared to, say, a supermarket here. There aren't 57 varieties of milk.
That's right.
That's not a bad thing, by the way.
No.
But we've got to get used to that. And but I think it'll keep playing itself out, really, I do.
Yeah. Graham, coming back to Australia, you've visited year after year to visit family, but pretty much been away for 20 years. What did you notice about the state of Christianity in Australia after 20 years?
Well, that's a good question. I think when I left back in 2002, at the beginning of 2002, there was a lot of apathy. There was a lot of ignorance about biblical Christianity and the Jesus we find in the Gospels. And there was a little bit of hostility. I think what I've found coming back finally in 2021 is that there's a lot more hostility, especially amongst the chattering classes. And the criticism is a moral criticism. And I think that the Royal Commission has really made an impact on the trust factor. The onus, I think, in so many minds seems to have shifted that the Christian has to show that he or she is really an authentic person worth knowing. I think that's one of the big differences, rather than simply being, of course a decent Australian lives by Judeo-Christian values.
Of all the things that you've been involved in, Graham, and by God's grace, you've had a huge impact on Christians all over the world. When you reflect on all of that, Graham, what are you most proud of?
Oh, goodness me. Well, like what my late father-in-law, my preacher father-in-law said, you don't want praise in the Christian life, you want encouragement. So what's encouraged me?
Mm.
I think what encourages me when I hear from people, you know, you preached X and I came to Christ.
Yes.
You said X and that bit of wisdom has helped me. Yeah. In so many ministry contexts.
Mm.
And it's true of my wife too. We're in the Birmingham Botanical Gardens and got to talking to a lady there, and turned out she was a Christian. She was thinking of leaving her husband. And Jules said, look, I made vows to my husband when we got married. I didn't make them to my children, so I was free to come to America, which is a very wise observation. And I will stick to those vows. Well, some years later, we went back on a visit to Birmingham, and that same woman was in that same botanical garden store. She took what Jules said in that conversation to heart, and it saved their marriage. So those sorts of stories, you know.
Yeah.
As Elie Wiesel said, the Nobel Prize winner, God loves humanity. He created them because they make stories, because he loves stories. And it's those stories that I think are the great encouragement for me, that I'm really buzzed by.
Yeah. That's great, Graham. Oh, it's been such a joy to talk with you. Thank you for sharing something of your life with us today.
Thank you, Jenny. Great privilege.
I hope you've enjoyed being part of the conversation with Graham today, and importantly, been encouraged to be salt and light to those around you. And that brings us to the end of season 5. Oh, what a journey it's been. We've been to Pakistan, to the heart of government in New South Wales, and we've talked to puppets who speak for God. We hope you've enjoyed coming along with us, and we're really looking forward to bringing you season 6. So stay tuned for some announcements, and I hope to see you then. Salt is hosted by me, Jenny Salt, and produced by Mark Hadley. Editing by Hadley Inc. For all show notes and more episodes, head to sbc.edu.au/salt. Salt is a Sydney Missionary and Bible College podcast and part of the Eternity Podcast Network, an audio collection showcasing the seriously good news of faith today. Thanks for making Salt possible.